Julie Cohen and Betsy West, welcome to the Picture House podcast, and we are here today to discuss Julia, your wonderful documentary celebrating the life and work of Julia Child.
Julia was more than a cook. She was a cultural force. She changed America.
We need to tell how important this woman is, was, will be.
You could say Julia, and everybody knew it was Julia Child.
This is Julia Child. Bon appétit.
Can you both tell me when and where you fell in love with Julia Child?
Yeah, well, you know, Julia Child is kind of big presence in America. And so I feel like I've known about Julia, seen her on television since I was a kid. But I didn't really know the whole story of Julia until we started working on this film. Someone came to us with the idea and it occurred to us, wow, this woman really changed America, changed how we think about food, how we cook. I mean, she really had a significant impact on our culture. And yet, what's her story? You know, how did she get to be Julia? And it turns out, you know, it's a pretty unexpected story of a person who was going down one route, who had a kind of pretty good life, you know, growing up, relatively privileged life, but was restless and wanted something more. And in the process wound up doing something pretty extraordinary to introduce Americans, not only to French food, but just to good food, because we hadn't eaten that well, you know, in our own childhoods. And I think we appreciated what Julia did for us.
Well, I mean, some of the food images of pre-Julia were pretty horrific. And it was pretty similar in England, you know, like...
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's something that, like, actually Americans and the British share is, like, a question, a sort of ugly culinary past. I mean, I don't know if in England there was quite the level of creativity in how disgusting dinner party food could be. The idea of suspending so many different I guess you guys have your aspect, like so many, the whole idea of vegetables like suspended in a colorful gelatin.
Which yes, absolutely.
Was so, popular in America. And, you know, it wasn't just ordinary dinner at home that was bad. It was actually food served for celebrations that were, you know, sometimes kind of like alarmingly bad. And, you know, Julia Child herself, who, as Betsy says, is just an extraordinarily well-known figure in America and someone that we certainly saw grew up seeing on television, you know, because of the funny voice and the somewhat comedic presentation, there's a temptation to maybe trivialize Julia and think of her as a little bit of a joke, especially because maybe the most famous, you know, impression that everyone has of her in the States is Dan Aykroyd's Saturday Night Live, you know, in a wig with false breasts, like dancing around over a raw chicken where he has cut himself rather troublingly. Julia herself found this quite hilarious, as you'll see in our film. But yet, you know, as the decades go on, like if that's what you remember about who Julia Child is, you have really missed the point, because she actually had a hugely important impact on our culture in this country, and probably, you know, maybe by extension in other countries as well.
And I love the opening piece that you chose for her, because you immediately knew who she was, what she was doing. And I thought it was inspired to have her cooking along to Jimi Hendrix as well. Yeah, I mean, tell me about that, Betsy, that opening scene.
How did you think on that? Yeah, I think we wanted to make the point that Julia was kind of a revolutionary in her own way. We actually tried that open with a number of different songs, and we had some Mozart, which seemed appropriate for Julia, but a little expected. And, you know, the fact was that Julia did kind of rock our world, and we wanted to show you that. And also to tee up just the sensuality and the the beautiful love of great, fantastic food. I think you'll see in the film that, you know, Julia loved eating, loved preparing fantastic food, and it was very sensual. And that kind of extended to her whole life. I mean, she had a very sensual, sexy relationship with her husband. And, you know, these things all went together. So Jimmy seemed like the right person to convey that.
Completely. And, you know, at the time, people would have argued that rock and roll was just a noise, not an art form. And in America, you know, people didn't discuss food. It's not an art form. It's not some, you know, and the orchestra of food and the orchestra of rock and roll are absolutely symbiotic, I think. So, yeah. So she was in so many ways, though, a woman in the right place at the right time, like born in the 20s, which was a great time of social change. And but she still needed to be very brave and pioneering. It wasn't like everything just opened for women in any way whatsoever. But she was buoyed by society's evolution. What would you say about that, Julie?
Yeah, you know, it's a complicated situation because Julia grew up extremely fortunate. In today's parlance, we'd say she was very privileged, and there's really no question that that was true. In some ways, you know, the world was her oyster. She was from a wealthy family in California, and there was never a question that like life would be sort of easy for her. You know, she describes it at one point. We have so much of her lovely voice talking about different things in the film, and one soundbite we loved, she was living a leisurely butterfly life. And I think that actually describes it pretty nicely, because like on the one hand, like, oh, isn't that lovely and colorful and you're just floating on the breeze, but on the other hand, like, no human being wants to be a butterfly. Like, butterflies aren't ambitious, they're not, you know, out there to change the world, they're just going to look pretty and kind of flit around. And Julia had a thought of really wanting something more in a time when the idea of women wanting more was almost just like confusing to everyone. Like, because of her privileged background, it was like, oh, yes, go to Smith College, this very good college where you're going to get a wonderful education. But then, like, you know, then the whole point is you're just going to marry a really nice guy who's going to take care of you for the rest of your life. And, you know, you may have children. In the end, Julia was unable to have kids. But the idea that you might have your whole own idea of what world you wanted to create for yourself just wasn't something that was available to women at that time. Even luckier women who grew up with wealth and privileged and the opportunities that affords.
I do think that there was something in a way serendipitous about the time and about the opportunity that World War II presented for Julia Child and for many other American women. I mean, it turns out Julia wasn't the only restless one and leapt at the chance, as did thousands of women, to join the war effort, whether or not they were working in factories in the United States or they were volunteering to go, as Julia did, overseas and went to the Far East. This opened up Julia's eyes, and, you know, it's where she met her husband Paul, who was a older and very sophisticated guy who really educated her more about the world and just gave her opportunities that she would not have had she stayed in Pasadena, California. So, you know, luckily for Julia, I mean, many of the women who had the advantage of some kind of liberation in World War II then had to go back to the kitchen when their husbands came back from the war, if they did return from the war. And Julia had the good fortune to marry a man who was in the State Department and was posted to Paris. And that's sort of where, you know, her life totally transformed.
It is, and also her life is a great example of truly being in touch with yourself and following your heart, even though that is something that wasn't necessarily open to many women. And, you know, you can't forget the indoctrination of women, no matter how much society was opening up. You know, she was able to understand and know herself, wasn't she? She didn't want that husband. She did join the war effort. She did choose to be with Paul despite her father. And she did go to the cordon bleu despite being a woman. You know, she did do all this, which I just think you have to have extraordinary sense of yourself to do that.
Yeah, what do you think? Did have a strong sense of herself and was an intelligent, thoughtful person. I think, too, that she was very freed by not living in the country she was born with at the time. Like, the whole idea of moving, which really was serendipitous, it was only because her husband decided that he was going to be going and taking a job in the Foreign Service in France, that the two of them are living in Paris. And it was just, that was just a whole new world for her. She just loved the French way of life. And a big part of what she loved about it was how much of it was focused on food. That's just not the way that, you know, when we're talking about around 1950, that's not the way American people were thinking or British people were thinking. There's like something like in our cultures, there's something a little bit like, we're all a little too uptight to be like really get into like a love of food, specifically in that era. But the French weren't like that. Like, you know, going to the market and just marveling over the freshness of a fantastic artichoke or like how you prepare it or what it's like, that was just a big value in France. And it was something that Julia found dazzling. She loved the food. And then she thought, like, wouldn't it be wonderful? I'm looking for something to do. My husband's at work all day. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could learn how to cook this food myself? And when she went to the Cordon Bleu and they tried to sort of shunt her off to a class that was for housewives, she said, no way, I want to be in a professional class. And there she was with 11 men.
Yeah, and it just occurred to me, I saw one of the photographs with her talking with the chef, and her height gives her a really sort of quite intimidating sort of presence, doesn't it? And I just wondered, has that got a lot to do with her success at that time? You know, like, you could just see her leveling up with these men. What do you think, Betsy?
I think that might have given her some confidence. I mean, there's some debate. Was she 6'2"? Was she 6'3"? I mean, she was really tall, really, really tall. And yet, you know, some tall women are embarrassed of it and kind of stoop down. Julia never did that. She stood up straight. She was proud of her height. Her siblings were also very tall. So it was like a really tall family. And it seems that she did have some confidence. And certainly she was looking eye to eye with the men she was working with, if not looking down on them. And that perhaps that helped her be more confident. But I think it's more just, she had this kind of joie de vivre, just pushing ahead. She, you know, one of the things in the course of making the film was we were looking for Julia ruminating on tough times that she had. You know, what was it like when the people at Cordon Bleu were mean to you, you know, or what was it like when you had breast cancer? And these were things that Julia kind of didn't talk about. She was very much just keep moving forward, keep going. So we did get a few diary entries to give some insight to her deeper life, you know, her love of Paul, her infatuation with Paul. But she didn't really talk about the sexism particularly. She just like, move on.
She was such an anomaly in that way, wasn't she? Like, becoming a TV celebrity in her 50s. I mean, even now, that's pretty much unheard of for a woman to do that, you know. And yes, you can say it was serendipity that she was around at the time, but it was this extraordinary confidence. And I thought Paul's sonnet to her was particularly brilliant at summing her up. And she was nature. She was a force of nature, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely she was. And she was so unique and so different in every way. And the funny thing is that, you know, the corporate decision makers, like the television executives, are sort of always trying to give you something. I mean, there's an analogy to food almost. People are always trying to give you something that's packaged and the same and familiar. That's what they think their audience is going to want. Julia just happened to show up on that I've been reading like the very stuffy, you know, literature professor's TV public television program to talk about her new book, decided she wanted to cook an omelet on the show. That's spoiler alert, because we talk about that early in the film. And, you know, audiences were just taken with her. The fact that she was 50, the fact that she was not petite, not a classic beauty, had this crazy, let's face it, like, her voice is crazy. That's not a voice a person is supposed to have. Like, that she was this whole antic, you know, bigger, larger than life in every way personality and that she was teaching and instructing something that like nobody wanted a woman to do in 1963. But in fact, the audiences loved it, and not just female audiences. Men and women immediately responded to seeing her, immediately called into the station. That's why they decided that they were going to take a chance and give her a pilot, do three episodes, you know, for which they paid her $50 a pop. I mean, it wasn't like a huge risk, you know, and the audience loved it.
We were very lucky that her producer, Russ Marash, was a very young man when he started working with Julia, which means he's still around to tell the story. And he just talks about Julia's authenticity, how she was a natural. She was not afraid of the camera. She loved the camera. She understood the theatricality of the whole thing. She and her producer understood it. It was like, you know, come on with a bang and leave with a bang and give people something entertaining. And that was something, you know, she was very, very comfortable on camera, and people sensed that and just got a kick out of it. And then, of course, people used to accuse her of making mistakes on purpose as part of this. And as she said, look, anybody who's ever worked in the kitchen knows that things go wrong. And the whole point is just keep going, figure out how to adjust. And she actually liked making mistakes because it did allow her to show the audience what to do when something didn't quite work out the way you intended.
And there was an incredible warmth to her. I don't know if you had encountered Fanny Craddock, which is our equivalent. I know Fanny has a different meaning, but that's a name over here. And she was our TV chef, but she was very brittle and very much about doing absolutely everything just so and not making mistakes. And I think it gave the British public a terrible fear of food and going anywhere near kind of haute cuisine or whatever it's called, you know. But also I was really, really struck by how diligent and how hard she worked. I mean, her production notes were off the scale precise, and they must have taken her hours. And I wonder, do you think this is more than anything the secret of her success?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of, you know, having the right stuff as a television character. And then on top of that, being willing to put in the hard work to always be extremely prepared and to perfect whatever she was doing. I mean, she did a lot of many, many, many hours of television, and she got better and better and better at it.
Certainly writing the book shows how hard she was willing to work. I mean, it, you know, it was over a decade in the making at a time, you know, when there was no internet, and she's exchanging letters with her collaborators and also getting discouraging responses from her publishers. I mean, it was tough work. There was not a lot of encouragement, except for maybe from her husband. No idea that this was, you know, people are saying, ah, who wants a big, heavy book with all the details of how to cook really well? American housewives aren't going to want to bother with this. And she believed in it and put in the work to do recipes over and over and over again till she got it just right.
And it was interesting that it was a woman who picked the book up in the end, wasn't it?
Yes,
who,
yes.
You know, the people that it's not aimed at, the men were like, oh, no, women don't want to read this.
Right. Yeah.
And I was just very struck as well how beautifully researched the documentary was. There were so many lovely photographs and I mean, her whole life, it must have been so painstaking for you both, and the generosity of the family and the people that you interviewed. Tell me about putting the documentary together for you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, painstaking, yes, but mostly just like a really joyous, joyful process. And we hope that comes through for viewers of the film as well. There are so many beautiful still photographs that we were able to use, many of them taken by Paul Child, Julia's husband, who was quite a skilled amateur photographer, and where you can just feel, you know, his love kind of seeping out of the through the camera. You know, so many writings. As I said, there are many, many audio and video recordings we were able to find of Julia, some of which hadn't been heard before. And, you know, I mean, I feel like I want to say, since we're talking to a British audience, that part of what brings this so beautifully to life in the film is our score by the fantastic British composer Rachel Portman, who specializes in narrative films, has done Emma and Chocolat and Cider House Rules and so many others. And just, you know, adding that material, I think, adding the visual material with that beautiful score, not to mention the food photography.
The food photography, goodness me, that's it. I definitely have to mention that. I mean, I was salivating through most of the documentary, but yes, the cinematography when it came to your food filming was just, the pears poached in red wine tart, it nearly made me lose my mind. So I have to go and eat that. But yeah, tell me about actually making the recipes yourselves and filming them.
Well, I'm really sorry to say we did not make those recipes. We had our amazing food stylist, Susan Spungen, who did Julie and Julia, the narrative film, you know, a decade ago. She was the stylist. So those are Susan's hands that you see making that beautiful pear tart. And Susan collaborated with us on what iconic recipes we would select to cook. And then she did the cooking, and it was her suggestion of the pear tart, what we now refer to as the sexy pear tart, to illustrate Julia and Paul's sexy relationship. We were thinking, you know, chocolate is pretty sexy, but just the many steps in making the pear tart and the boiling of the pears and the kneading of the dough and everything else, it was pretty good. We had two cinematographers. Our Claudia Raschke, who's our regular cinematographer here in New York, and our producer had a kitchen, a replica Julia Child kitchen made in a studio downtown, and, you know, complete with the old refurbished Garland stove and the pegboard and everything. And that's where Susan did her work and where Claudia was filming for a week these various recipes. Meanwhile, we had a cinematographer in Paris who specializes in food photography, Nanda Bretelard, and he was doing all of the slow-mo and the tight shots and all the dripping of the pear sauce and, you know, some of those more sensual things, which our editor then edited together. So they're actually, our editor, Carla Gutierrez, you know, brilliantly edited together. So you don't really know that there was a pear tart that was made in New York and one that was made in Paris. And then she intercut that to kind of make the most of the food. You know, we really, really wanted to just make it as sumptuous as possible, in contrast to, you know, what Julia had to do with black and white photography back in the 1960s. You know, the food wasn't really the main show. Julia was the show, not the food. So we had the opportunity to kind of insert some of that, those great images.
And finally, what do you think Julia's legacy means now today for America or the world even, or for women?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are legacies in all those things. Certainly, Julia has had a huge legacy on the food world, not only the sort of interest of ordinary people in delicious, fresh cooking, but the whole idea that a chef can be a celebrity. Like, Julia was really the first major celebrity chef in the States, but she was not the last. Like, now, many chefs from great restaurants in New York or Los Angeles or throughout, or, you know, and London as well, like the chefs of the big restaurants are stars. And Julia's right at the start of that movement.
What do you think, Betsy?
Yeah, I mean, I think she has become an icon for people in the food world and for people who love to eat. And her story to me is one of just wonderful optimism and possibilities. You know, one thing doesn't work out, just keep trying, just keep going. You know, you see how she, as you say, she didn't become famous until she was 50, and then she went on for four decades devoted to this thing that she loved. Like, she found a passion and she just gave her all to it. I think that's pretty inspiring.
I would completely agree. And I'm so excited. I've got another four decades, I hope, of doing this.
Yes.
But thank you so much for joining me on the Picture House podcast. It's been wonderful to speak with you both.
It's been great delightful. We hope people enjoy the film, and we know you can bring a glass of wine into the theater, and we highly, highly recommend that for this film.
Definitely. Maybe a snack too.
Oh yes, what would be the cinema snack? We do a very nice cake at Picture House, so I think Julia would approve.
Julia would love that.
Yes, Julia. One of Julia's great lines is, "A party without cake is just a meeting." So, like, a movie without cake is like there's no point to it. She might
exactly. Oh, thank you so much, both, and good luck with the documentary. It's wonderful. I loved it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.